Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our Week in Review.
Black lives matter, and that's why we're here, and we will not stop until our voices are heard and until we are equal.
This week, that demonstrator and more than 1,400 others marched through the streets of Boston to protest the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Also, UMass Amherst and Berklee College of Music cut ties with Bill Cosby after at least 15 women accused the comedian of sexual misconduct.
I was crying and he said, I'll take you home. I was not raped, but I was groped and terrorized.
Meanwhile, Governor-elect Charlie Baker continues to pick a diverse group of people to serve in his cabinet.
I've always considered him to be a spectacular manager, leader, administrator, and public servant. And the fact that he's a Democrat is almost beside the point.
Plus, startling new numbers detailing the affordable housing crisis in Massachusetts. Join us now to talk about these stories is John Carroll, communications professor at BU and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog, and Dante Ramos, a columnist on the op-ed page of the Boston Globe. John and Dante, always good to have you both on the show.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
So let's talk Ferguson first. This protest in Boston was on Tuesday night. As we said, a crowd of about 1,400 started in Dudley Square, marched around Boston to protest the decision by a Missouri grand jury not to indict a white police officer in the shooting death of Michael Brown, who was unarmed at the time.
We are going to South Bay Correction. We are going to go visit our people. We are going to go let them know that their lives matter as well. All right?
Marchers did go to the South Bay Jail, and the Boston protest was one of many around the country. The theme of the demonstrations was Black Lives. And I should note that I was driving to South Boston that night from BUR, the station near Kenmore Square, and right around Melniacast Boulevard and Mass Ave intersection, sudden gridlock, then the sirens, then the police helicopters. So I very much experienced what that was like that night. So Dante and John, I'm interested in your general impressions, the forcefulness of the protest or lack of, the impact of its message. John, you start us off.
Well, one of the things that was interesting was the diversity of the crowd. I think that said a lot for Boston and the people who were trying to raise their voices in terms of protesting this non-decision by the grand jury out in Ferguson. I think also that there were two interesting sort of narratives that were being spun out. One was the police commissioner William Evans saying, you know, we restrained ourselves, we kept the riot gear out of sight. We basically tried to make this as soft a handling of the protesters as possible. Then you had the 50 who were arrested who said the police were excessively forceful, excessively violent. I think probably they're both right to some degree. I don't think it was quite the pajama party that Commissioner Evans said it was, but I also think that given 1,400 people, the number of arrests and the incidents were pretty low.
Right, you're right. I think the commissioner or the superintendent talked about, again, the soft touch or the soft approach. But again, as you say, we heard demonstrators arraign the next morning, show up with little black eyes and bruises,
right.
You know, knees and necks, that sort of thing. Dante, your impression of the evening?
I agree with all of what John said. I was struck. I think the environment in Boston, in a place where the kind of overall civic climate, if you want to call it that, and where most of the leadership is broadly sympathetic to some of the goals of the protesters, it takes a little bit of the sting that might have existed in some of the other places. And I think there's a... I don't think that we should pretend that everything between, as John said, between the police and the protesters was exactly perfect, but there was a sort of more cooperative atmosphere than in some other places. I would also note I was walking around in the Copley Square area as the protests kind of made their way around the Hancock Tower in that area, and I was struck by the deployment of police officers and the level of the kind of high level of tactical organization. And there's obviously a difference of scale between the Boston Police Department and a smaller department like Ferguson, but one of the issues in police crowd control is that organization and a high level of technical expertise is a very good substitute for the kind of militarization and show of force that you see in some of these other situations that have caused protests to get out of control and to cause a great deal of animosity.
And in Boston, of course, we have seen tragedies in the past when crowds have been out, even for celebratory reasons, not protests in the police. So do you think part of that soft touch, as described by the police, we saw this week was lessons learned from the tragedies of Boston in the past?
Absolutely.
Yeah, look, agreement in unison there.
Yeah. Both said at the same time. Absolutely. I think that there's a real sensitivity here. If I could just point out one other thing that struck me was in the sort of the community gathering that occurred that night, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh was there. Governor-elect Charlie Baker was there. Governor Deval Patrick was not there. He had left town early to go down to Atlanta for a family gathering for Thanksgiving. And I think that said something that did not reflect well on the governor. I think the fact that he was not there at a time when you would expect him to be there because of his background, because of his position in terms of race relations, I think that was a pretty glaring omission on his part.
And one of the papers, the Globe or the Herald this week, did interview a number of people about that, including some black ministers. Most of them, I felt, gave the governor a pass. They said, we believe we know where he stands on this. Let him have dinner with his in-laws. Dante, what was your thought on that?
In a way, I think it probably said more, again, about the local civic climate that the Republican governor-elect was in attendance. I agree that I think a lot of people know where Governor Patrick stands on this, and a lot of, he has made his sentiments known in other ways.
Mm. Totally different issue, which is Bill Cosby. Now, UMass Amherst, as we said, announced this week that it is severing ties with him. He's probably, maybe not the, but certainly one of the most famous alums of the school. And this is, of course, over reports of sexual misconduct by Cosby, by more than a dozen women over several decades. Cosby has been a major fundraiser for UMass, many hundreds of thousands of dollars he and his wife have given. The Attorney General, Martha Coakley, sent the school a letter urging the college to cut its ties in connection with sort of the issues about on-campus sexual assault. Now, Cosby hasn't been charged with a crime, so I'm interested in the thoughts the two of you have about the situation colleges who are linked to Cosby have been put in, given sort of the plethora of accusations, yet a lot of these remain officially unsubstantiated. John?
Yeah, I think the easy thing to do is to dump them. And I think the interesting part and the difficult part is the colleges who have stuck with him, specifically Spelman College, which is a women's college down in Atlanta. He's given a fair amount of money, $20 million. His wife's name is on one of the buildings. There's an endowed professorship. They have not distanced themselves from Cosby. The same is true of Morehouse School of Medicine, where he gave $3 million. I think that that's the more difficult thing to do. It's going to be interesting to see if pressure comes down on them to essentially divorce themselves from Cosby. But I think it's a murky enough situation legally that it puts colleges in a difficult situation. I think the court of public opinion is pretty well settled, although he did get two standing ovations in Florida over the weekend, so at a concert.
Interesting.
So, but I think that largely he's been convicted in the court of public opinion, but I think a lot of colleges aren't going to rush to judgment on it.
And Dante, before we have you weigh in, let's hear a piece of sound from one of the women accusing him. This is a former Playboy model. Her name is Victoria Valentino, and she says that Cosby drugged and raped her in 1970, so many decades ago.
He's been lauded over the years, you know, the PhD, the great family man, his legacy. Well, this is his true legacy.
Now, UMass Amherst isn't the only local school to cut ties. Berklee College of Music had an online scholarship at awards that his name was on, and they have cut ties as well by removing his name. Dante, do you feel the schools were right in this case to distance themselves from Cosby?
I think they absolutely were. It's ironic that this comes at a time when the colleges themselves are dealing with, they're under pressure from the U.S. Department of Education and from student groups and from faculty groups also, because colleges are often in a position precisely in situations where the legal status of claims of sexual assault is that they feel forced to render judgment about the merits or lack of merits of a case. And one of the things that they end up looking into in many cases is if there's a a pattern of accusations of sexual misconduct that even if there hasn't been a long paper trail in the legal system, if there are a series of accusations that all kind of sound similar, that is something that the internal review processes that exist in these colleges tend to take a look at.
And Dante, let me jump in for a minute, because certainly in the Cosby case, these aren't sort of strictly campus rape cases, but do you think it's fair, for example, Martha Coakley to say at a time when we're trying to encourage female, usually it's female students, to speak up about alleged rapes, is it fair to draw a connection between women reluctant to speak up against Cosby as a big celebrity? John and Dante, do you feel that way? Is it a fair connection between the two?
I think it is.
Go ahead, Dante. Go ahead.
I think it is a fair connection in the sense that the whole crux of the discussion on college campuses is how do you create a situation in which victims feel like they can that they can bring their concerns forward and have people who are the subject of complaints also feel like they are not being unfairly maligned. I think that there's not an exact legal parallel between what happens within the campus and there has to be a sort of between the campus and the legal system, and there has to be an independent judgment that's rendered.
John, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think it's a high wire act that a lot of the colleges are dealing with now in terms of sexual abuse cases and the government. And I think a lot of them, their tendency is to err on the side of caution. And I think that it does play a role.
So political question about the Charlie Baker picks, the team being assembled, of course, by the governor-elect. This week, he picked Kristen Lepore to be the next state secretary of administration and finance, a job he once held. Now, Charlie Baker talked with our Morning Edition host, Bob Oakes, this week and was explaining his thinking about his cabinet selections, even if they cross party lines, as they did in the case of Jay Ash, who's a Democrat, the city manager of Chelsea. Jay Ash is now heading housing and economic development for the state. And here's what Charlie Baker said about that.
One of the advantages of getting elected governor when you're 58 instead of 38 is you have some mileage on you, and part of that means some history and some relationships with people who've spent a fair amount of their career in the public and in the private sector. And somebody like Jay Ash, who was one of our early appointments, I've known Jay Ash forever, and I've always considered him to be a spectacular manager, leader, administrator, and public servant. And the fact that he's a Democrat is almost beside the point.
Now, we also have, as other cabinet picks, Mary Lou Sutter. She's going to be the commissioner of the Department of Mental... Oh, no, sorry. She's going to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. She was previously commissioner of the Department of Mental Health. We have his chief of staff. We have Energy and Environmental Affairs. John Carroll, your sense so far about the cabinet as it's coming together?
Yeah, this is a real Whitman sampler. You've got a couple of Democrats, a couple of Republicans. You've got somebody who's unenrolled. I think one of the things that's interesting is the through line seems to be that Charlie Baker is picking people who have experience both in the private sector and in government.
Like him, exactly.
And I think that that is something that will probably serve him well in terms of people coming in and being ready to take over and being ready to sort of organize the administration. I think that he's a Republican in an overwhelmingly Democratic state. There's no way that he can't jump into the Democratic sandbox and play there. So he's got to show this not just to the public but to the Democrats on Beacon Hill that he has a sense of, you know, we're all in this together. So there's not going to be these sort of hard and fast sides clashing with each other all the time.
And Dante, what do you think the state's GOP in particular thinks about these picks?
I think they're about what the state's GOP would have predicted. They're very long on veterans of the Weld and Cellucci administrations, as Baker himself is, includes the chief of staff as someone who had been at Harvard Pilgrim. There's a strong flavor of previous GOP administrations and people who are in Baker's network. So I don't think that anyone in the state Republican Party would expect a much more conservative or ideological slate of people. One appointment that is kind of interesting is Matt Beaton, who's the appointee for energy and environment. And this is an area where the issues have morphed a lot since the Weld and Cellucci administrations.
Right. Interesting story about him today in the Globe. He's a guy in his, mid-30s, state rep from Shrewsbury, and the idea was that at least some people in the environmental community feel that his resume is a little light, at least compared to people who've held this job in the past.
I think it's an area where there is probably not that deep of a bench on the Republican side. Beaton has interesting and appropriate educational credentials and work credentials, but there is a potential feud brewing here between Baker and the environmentalists, and it has to do with natural gas capacity. There's a feeling among the business community and some ratepayers that electricity prices are really high and getting more natural gas into the state is a really easy way to deal with that. Environmentalists are very dead set against this and feel like conservation and renewables are really the only way to go about bringing more power in Massachusetts in the future. And this is an area that could represent a fault line, and Beaton could find himself at the center of it.
All right, let's close out this week's Week in Review with our hubbubs. You guys have both done these before, those little stories that kind of fell below the fold, literally or figuratively, but did catch your eye. So, John Carroll, what's your hubbub this week?
My hubbub is the New York Times has run its first print native ad, which is, you remember, native advertising is marketing material that mirrors the editorial environment around it. The Times has been doing this since January on its website, but this is the first one that's actually appeared with the print edition of the newspaper. I have it right here, actually. It's a nice 8-page insert wrapped in vellum. This is terrific radio, I know.
We can hear the paper rustling.
Yeah, exactly. It's for Shell, and it's interesting because this is potentially a big source.
It's
of
for Shell.
Revenue,
Shell oil.
Shell
okay.
oil, and it's about the urbanization of the world population, and it's got all kinds of bells and whistles. You can hold your smartphone over it and play videos. Mm. The whole thing is a really major production, and the interesting part of this is the New York Times has been insistent that they'll have the highest level of transparency in terms of native advertising. The problem is the nature of native advertising is to, at best, misdirect the viewer, the reader, if not outright deceive the reader. So this is going to be a tug of war that goes on for a while. But the fact that this has gone over into print is sort of a new stage for the Times and for a lot of publications. There's potentially a lot of ad revenue here.
Huh, and an issue that you and John in particular in your work follow, so we'll have to keep up on that. Dante, your hubbub this week?
Speaking of the Times, they reported this week that there is a surplus of cranberries, and the industry, which has a strong presence here in Massachusetts, is desperate for ways to get people to use them up.
And not just on Thanksgiving.
Exactly. So the Cranberry Marketing Committee, which is based in Wareham, has trademarked the phrase America's original superfruit in a way to capitalize on health trends, and they're pushing cocktails like the Cranberry Margarita and the Cranberry Sunset and even Crangria, which is like sangria, but with cranberry juice.
I guess anything that adds a little vitamin C to your cocktail, we have to give it credit, right? I mean, that's a good thing.
Exactly. But the extent of the cranberry glut can be measured in bad puns. When an industry official was asked by the Times about his efforts to expand the market, he said, "We have to think outside the bog." So there
that's
we are.
Painful.
I can see an animated Sunday morning or Saturday morning show for kids with the superfruit.
And I did read, it may have been that article, Dante, that I read that apparently they found more ways to get more yield. It's not just by sort of juicing the fruits in terms of, you know, growth, you know, not sort of a Miracle-Gro type thing, but more ways to get more cranberries out of the bog. So we keep seeing more efficiencies in every industry, basically.
Right. It's not as though lots of more bogs are being produced. It's just the bogs are a lot more productive.
Exactly. Now, my hubbub is a little different this week. It's a combination goodbye and hello. So this is my last day on the air at BUR, at least for the sort of near future. I am leaving to go write a weekly column for the Boston Globe about nonprofits and philanthropy and giving, and then to help build a new reporting beat that will look really broadly at wealth and wealth management and power. This is part of a new effort by the Globe to really expand its business section, which has been sort of shrinking for many years, and now they want to restore most days of the week to an 8-page standalone section. So I'm going to help them build that. So Dante, I'll be seeing you much more often in the hallways of the Boston Globe, but John, probably you much less because you're here much more at BUR than you are.
We will miss you very much, Sasha.
And I will miss it, but I am excited to be back in the print world. It's a fun type of reporting and editing, and the Globe has some broadcast ventures that I hope means that the radio skills will still be used. So, John, I'll miss you too. Dante, be looking forward to seeing you in person more often.
Welcome back to Morrissey Boulevard.
Thank you.
All best, Sasha.
Thank you. And stay with us. Coming up, the history of the birth control pill is a very controversial history, in fact. And you might not know that the pill was developed in Worcester. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.